Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:45 in that specific summer time, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Today being September 11th, I think a lot of people will be taking a moment to think about what happened 14 years ago, but the market complexion today is really quite different from back then. Although what we continue to see is that the political situation in the Middle East has done nothing but deteriorate since then, and there's a lot of panic, and there's a lot of people thinking, what's going to happen with these people, and what are they going to do in terms of trying to further their political agenda by attacking the West? That's very much an open question, and I think it's part of the risk that we're going to that's going to prevail over the next decade. This is certainly not an issue that's been put to bed, and the fact that governance has just simply failed to improve right across the region is symptomatic of the of what's happening there right now. The fact that energy prices are still coming down and they have yet to demonstrate more than a temporary low is also putting great pressure on a number of these countries. The announcement this week that Eni of Italy has discovered a supergiant gas field off the coast of Egypt is actually very good news, particularly for Egypt because it's an energy importer and also the country with the largest population in the region. It's been generally steady despite the fact that the democratic elections threw up the wrong answer, so it was overtaken by the military. So that's not exactly a step forward in terms of governance, but it is relatively stable, particularly when compared to much of the rest of the region. When you've got Saudi Arabia fighting a war on three fronts, this is still a very taut environment. It hasn't had a great deal of impact on oil prices. In fact, it has helped to depress oil prices because countries in the region need all the money they can get, and that's particularly true of both Saudi Arabia and Iran. When you look broadly, then there has been a massive infusion of capital into the energy sector over the last 15 years, and that drove a substantial bull market in commodity prices and is contributing to the decline in commodity prices that has been evident over the last few years, and that's been particularly true of the energy sector over in this year. I guess the oldest adage from the commodity sector is that the cure for high prices is high prices, and that has certainly been true in energy and indeed in the industrial commodities. The soft commodities is a little bit different because one of the reasons that prices had been so low was because of the supply-oriented policies of Europe and the USA, and by introducing quotas and dispensing with the grain mountains and the butter mountains and the wine lakes in Europe, that has helped to drive international prices for commodities higher. That then led to a commodity bull market and a farming boon right across the world. But that has then led to increasing supplies, which has pushed prices down. But they're still nowhere near where they would have been 10 years ago. And part of the reason for that is because we still do not have the massive overhang of supply, particularly in Europe and in North America, that we would have had 10 years ago. This is a very different environment, and because governance might not be improving in much of the Middle East, but it is improving in terms of raising the living standards of hundreds of millions of people in the major population centers. That's particularly true of India, and China has done an incredible job of lifting hundreds of millions of people out of abject poverty and into the middle classes. Now, obviously, China has got a long way to go, and it has to introduce reform. it has to continue to improve if it is to avoid the middle income trap. And I think an easy way to think of the middle income trap is to think about it in terms of just ordinary people. That they, how many people get as far as a college degree and then decide that that's good enough and that they want to start making money, so they don't go off and do a PhD. Then it's very similar for countries, that they do the necessary reforms and they're rewarded for it beyond their expectations. But introducing the additional reforms to move from a middle income to a high income country or economy requires really steely resolve. And well, there's no reason to believe that the Chinese don't have that resolve and that they're playing a game for the medium to long term. But there's every chance that this is going to be a rocky transition, that moving away from an environment where you've had just incredible investment in infrastructure and in property development and building out capacity for your very large employing basic industry is now over, and they're attempting to transition to a more services and higher margin manufacturing model. Well, China is a very large country with an incredibly large population. So obviously there is going to be a steel industry. There is going to be a cement industry. There's going to be a construction industry. There's going to be a real estate factor. It's going to be a large part of any major economy, but probably not as large as people had been anticipating. And a lot of the investment that went into commodity export terminals and additional capacity was based upon growth forecasts that are unlikely to come true. And it means that the pullback that we're currently seeing in commodities is responding to that. Then it means that the lowest cost producers and those that are least leveraged are going to probably be the ones that survive best. And higher cost producers are being squeezed out of the market. Well, this week we saw Glencore announcing that they were going to be in really quite a considerable capital raising effort. Well, Glencore isn't one of those companies that had been paying a substantial dividend, but it does raise the prospect that other companies are also going to have to engage in revenue raising efforts. Well, Glencore went from 300 to 133 over the last 6 months, and it is way overextended. So it is now time to start thinking about just how much bad news is already in the price, because a trend ending, the number one trend ending, type one trend ending that we talk about at the chart seminar is acceleration, and the share has almost halved in the last 6 months. So there's a lot more bad news priced in now than there would have been 6 months ago. And the first clear upward dynamic is probably going to suggest that we are in at least a period of time where mean reversion is evident. And generally speaking, when capital raising starts, you would anticipate that the price goes lower. But if we can get some sort of confirmation that that's the end of the capital raising, then prices generally start to go up again. Because fresh buyers start to come in. So when we look at this over the medium to long term, then this is a rocky period of time for emerging markets, not least because China is such an incredibly large heavyweight, not only because of the size of its domestic economy, but because of the trade that it does with other emerging markets. And emerging markets now represent about 50% of global GDP. So what happens in emerging markets matters. It matters a lot more now than it would have 10 years ago. Well, that's unlikely to change, despite the fact that emerging market currencies have been accelerating lower. That a great deal of the debt that has been taken on over the last 10 to 15 years was in US dollars. So the relative strength of the dollar compared to the relative weakness of the respective currencies is making the repayment schedules for this debt looking increasingly dicey. And Brazil in particular, is where the focus of attention is on, and not least because it was a darling for investors because it was running credit running surpluses during the commodity bull market. But Brazil's currency has gone from 1.6 to the US dollar to 3.8 since 2011. So that's more than a 50% decline, and you'd have to say that there's a lot of bad news is already in the price. Well, consider that in the depths of the credit crisis, the extent to which it fell was about 2.6, and it's now at 3.85 almost. There's an awful lot of bad news, but what we're probably going to require is that interest rates will have to pop higher in Brazil, that Dilma Rousseff might have to resign. That's looking unlikely, because there isn't really anybody to replace her. And this is where we're seeing that where governance really is important. We need to see that governance is improving. Well, we can see that governance is improving in India. And India's currency has also fallen, along with emerging market currencies, but not nearly to the same extent. And that you have a pretty sound central banker there, and you have a visionary leader in the form of Modi with the first absolute majority of any government in decades in India. So we do have evidence that governance is improving, but the problem with falling commodity prices and the problem with US dollar external debt for these countries is that no one is really concerned about governance when everything is going well, but the focus of attention turns very squarely onto governance when prices begin to fall, and that's definitely true in Latin America at present. Well, nobody was really worried about Venezuela because their governance has been all over the place for the last 10 years, and they didn't profit particularly well, and they basically closed their stock market to foreign investors when they appropriated ExxonMobil's assets about 10 years ago. So, but Venezuelan debt is held by foreign investors, and Venezuela's in all kinds of trouble because of the fall that we've had in oil prices. So the chances are that we are going to have some kind of sovereign default. And probably Venezuela is the country that is most likely to represent that. Petrobras is still under great pressure, not least because of the corruption scandals, but also because oil prices are low. Now, that's to talk an awful lot about the bad news, but we also know that we've already had a big decline, and it means then that a lot of that bad news is already in the price, and the very fact that we know what the bad news is, and that everybody is talking about what the bad news is, and that is very public knowledge, suggests that people have already taken actions either to protect their assets or to benefit from that bad news, which is, generally speaking, when you look at it and see that you have accelerating trends, that we are approaching a point where everyone who wants to have sold will have sold, and that's when bargain hunters can start to come back in. This week, we've seen a number of analysts talking about the potential for $20 oil, or at least oil, in the $20 region. Well, considering that oil prices, and we'll just, I guess, stick with Brent crude because it's the global benchmark, but prices in 2008, which represented really the biggest credit crunch in practically living memory, saw prices go as low as $38.37 on Brent crude. And the low towards the end of August was close to $42. And prices are currently at, give or take, around $48. Well, we had a nice bounce at the end of August, and that low has not been taken out. And if one were to be very bearish of oil prices, then that low posted at the end of August really would have to be taken out. It's also the region of the low that we saw in January, so it is an area of previous support. And the price action so far is that prices jumped in August, and they've come back more slowly. Well, late August meant that that was a short covering rally, because shorts have to be covered in a hurry because of margin calls, and prices have come back more slowly, suggesting that people have been less eager to really to open up large short positions. And as we come back towards a potential area of support at that August low, or the psychological $45 area, then that's where the interesting level will be. Will demand reassert itself, and will then the range between 45 and 70 represent the same kind of range that we saw in natural gas when natural gas prices collapsed, but 6 or 7 years ago? And natural gas has been just totally depressed since then. And the range is, well, prices have been really very depressed this year and have only ranged between about $2.50 and $3, and that's within an overall range starting from the middle of 2009, which is, you know, between about $2 and $6. And $6 has been an area of resistance even when we've had extraordinarily cold weather that has pumped up demand for a very short period of time. Prices didn't get above $6, and this could be what we're in for with oil prices, that prices could be in a volatile range. $45 to $70 is not quite a doubling, but it's a substantial rally from bottom to top of the range. And an awful lot of additional supply comes back into, becomes economic at those levels. Well, then we start to think about these things over the long term, that if we're in an environment where energy prices are not going back up to $100, that we could be in a volatile price environment for the foreseeable future. And even if we look back over this, look at this over the last 100 years, and you can do that in the chart library by typing in the ticker OILPHIST, so oil price history, and you'll get it going back all the way to the 1890s. And what we see is that you get long periods of time where prices range, and then you have big bull markets. And the most important factor is that prices have never come back into the previous range. And the upper side of the previous range is about $40. So we might dip and ebb and flow around that level, but I think that the potential for prices to get down to 20 is quite unlikely. And it would, the only possible scenario is that the sea of private equity money that is coming into the market might delay the rationalization process in North America. If that happens, then there is the potential that prices may come back. But if I was a private equity investor and I saw prices still holding here and no real bankruptcies, certainly we've had some companies get into distressed territory, but you know, if you were a fly on the wall at a private equity firm, you'd probably be keeping your powder dry, because buying today might mean that you don't get the better deal 6 months from now. So this is still a volatile environment for energy prices, but the medium-term lesson is that it's unlikely that we're going to get extraordinarily high prices once more. And that's just an incredibly beneficial factor for the types of economies that import energy. And that's particularly true for consumers. So this isn't something that I think has really been priced into a lot of markets. A lot of economists tend to think of that as deflationary, but rather that it's disinflation, that energy prices went up a lot and now they're coming back down. And in fact, that's going to set up a consumer that's going to be in much better health, and not least because consumers, particularly in North America and Europe, have been consolidating for much of the last 10 years, or at least since 2009, that they've been repairing their balance sheets and that they've been taking They've been trying to reduce their debt loads. And that means that when confidence does begin to pick up once more, that is going to contribute to wage inflation. Well, when we look at the emerging markets, then this has been a difficult environment. But, well, this is a very simple equation, that we're going to have upwards of an additional 3 billion people over the next 30 years. And most of those are coming from Africa, where governance is improving. And it means then that major population centers like Nigeria and Ethiopia, they have no choice but to embrace reform, or the weight of people and public sentiment will topple governments. And you know, we're starting to see that realization is starting to filter down into the administrations of these countries. So we're already seeing that factories are opening up and the development of a middle class and people working their way out of abject poverty. And this is exactly the kind of revolution that happened in Asia. And it's happening in an increasing number of countries in Africa. And that's where the real population growth is going to be. And also in India, China, and much of Asia. And provided administrations continue to embrace that improving governance mantra, then the potential for these economies to expand and represent major markets for consumer goods is still very much intact, despite the fact that we're seeing that their currencies have pulled back. But the other way to think about that is that once the currency has stabilized, then the competitiveness of these economies relative to their export markets also stabilizes, and that's when investment really starts to flow in. So despite the fact that emerging markets are coming down, then this is really setting us up for what could potentially be a very important buying opportunity, and not least in the high population areas. And as if that wasn't enough, then technological innovation is still the be-all and end-all, that we're in an accelerating period of time where technology is feeding upon itself to really drive the exponential growth of innovation. What we've seen is that there's a lot of people talking about the fact that productivity has not improved. Well, that is productivity per worker, but that's because workers are being replaced with robots. So logically, the productivity of the factory is improving and workers are being eliminated. And that really means that individual workers have to focus on their creativity. They have to start to think more about their technological edge and the kinds of jobs where people can do mundane work that could be mechanized are going to just disappear quite rapidly over the next decades, and not least if wage inflation starts to pick up. Then the argument for replacing humans with robots becomes really very compelling. The availability of technology is almost as important as the innovation in technology, because in previous bull markets, then availability of advanced technology would have been limited to advanced economies. But that's no longer the case, that global companies are making their technology available at progressively faster rates, and that, not least because of the internet, that global collaboration between universities, countries, and corporations is also accelerating. That's helping to drive a pace of innovation that we probably haven't seen in 100 years. And this is also something that has the potential to drive a major bull market. And against that background, we have to think about the distorting effects of extraordinary monetary policy. Ken Rogoff today was arguing that it would be madness for the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates when they only have tentative evidence that inflation is going to be back to their 2% target, and that they should really wait. And he was citing the fact that Federal Reserve models for predicting the future don't work, and that a number of central banks have raised rates only to have been forced to reduce rates shortly afterwards, that they should really wait for additional evidence. And that's an important consideration, because we're living in an environment where we have extraordinary monetary accommodation. That if you talk to someone 15 years ago and ask them, how many countries do you think will have zero interest rates? And they would have laughed in your face. They would say, well, Japan is the only country, and look at the extraordinary circumstances that you have there. So no, that's impossible. And yet now we're presented with an environment where three of the world's major economic blocks have interest rates that are virtually zero. And if nothing else, that forces people further out the risk curve in order to capture yield. What that does is it inflates asset prices. It perhaps doesn't do very much for the wider economy, because of the fact that banks are still rebuilding their balance sheets. What it does, more than any other factor, is it reduces the risk premium on markets, because you can borrow money for nothing. Well, this week, the euro and the yen were both firm. Certainly not in a dynamic fashion, but both the euro is back up to 113 and the yen is still hovering around 120. Well, one of the ways that people have been funding their trading has been to borrow euro and yen and invest it in higher yielding assets. And any strength in the euro or the yen puts pressure on those leveraged trades. So the corrective phase that we have been in for the majority of stock markets is not over. That, you know, the S&P was up about less than half a percent in here today. And this is still a touch-and-go environment. What we've had is that we had a bull market that progressed from 2009 and broke out to new all-time highs in 2013 and then improved really quite considerably on that performance. Well, this is still, if you go back and look at history, that these big breakouts from very lengthy ranges, and the range was all the way from 2000 to 2013, that's usually the sign of a secular bull market. What we're presented with right now is that the medium-term bull market that went from 2009 to recently is long in the tooth, and that some consolidation is warranted. And this is what we're getting, that the loss of momentum evident since January, which coincided with the end of the Fed's quantitative easing program, represented a loss of momentum. And what happens in a range is that the vacuum of demand below the market and a vacuum of supply above the market begin to form. It means that people below the market that have failed to purchase start to raise their bids up into the range, and the people that are still holding, they start to get impatient and they raise their stops, and it creates a vacuum of demand below the market. And when prices pull back, then they can fall rather aggressively, and that's what happens in every breakout. But after a lengthy ranging phase and loss of momentum and failed upside breaks, well, then you start to think about that as a type 2 top. And because people don't look at it, and they look at that action and they can't identify the catalyst, that why should Wall Street or Europe pull back so violently just because of a move in a market like China, where there are not a great number of foreign investors despite all the headlines? And they answer that question and say, well, it really shouldn't. So they start buying again. But that's to ignore the damage that's been done to sentiment by everyone who has either taken a loss or experienced profit erosion or become disillusioned with markets because of the volatility. Well, it means then that a period of support building is required, that it would be unreasonable to expect prices to go straight back up. And the only reason that they would go straight back up is if we get a fresh infusion of additional liquidity. But the bang for your buck in terms of central bank accommodation is less powerful when prices are three times what they were back in 2009. So the same amount of money infused into the market, it only buys a third as many securities as it would have back then. Well, then we're in an environment where the market has to perform on its own merits. And one of the reasons that companies like Google and Amazon have remained in reasonably consistent patterns is because they represent the hard edge of technological innovation. I suspect that with Apple, people aren't really interested in the new iPad or the iPad Professional. And you know that those are very minor changes. What could be truly transformative for the company is if they enter the credit markets. They have so much money sitting on the sideline, earning nominal rates of interest, that they could use their Alipay and start generating credit. And that would be a truly transformative innovation for the company. And it's something that Google and Facebook are already entertaining. That the kinds of things that drive major bull markets are innovation in healthcare, and we're certainly getting that through biotechnology, and the availability of healthcare to ever more people is also contributing to that secular bull market. Well, major declines in energy prices, and not just oil prices, but natural gas and coal, and the increasing efficiency of renewable sectors and innovation in the battery sector, that also contributes to secular bull markets, and the fact that you have a much larger market globally for your products contribute to a secular bull market. And innovation in the financial sector is an additional one. Well, there's the potential that rather than Bitcoin being an alternative currency, that the blockchain will be an alternative way of settling trades, of acting as a ledger, and particularly for the transfer of funds. And that's a very inefficient market. So these are the kinds of things that could really help to enable a secular bull market. The normalization eventually of interest rates, and we cannot anticipate that the extraordinary monetary accommodation that everyone has so complacently thought of as almost permanent will last indefinitely. Well, the fact that energy prices have come down is probably going to keep central banks from a tightening policy for a while longer, because it will register as deflation on their metrics, regardless of the fact that it would be more appropriately called disinflation. That we're still in an environment where people have already got large gains from an asset market that has appreciated considerably. That this is then an area where there are certainly opportunities arising because of accelerating downtrends. And the best time to buy is when something is really rock bottom. That's the point of maximum pessimism. That when you start to see a trend that has been accelerating lower begin to lose momentum, lose the consistency, and break progressions of lower rally highs, well then, that's odds on that we're going to get at least a reversionary rally. And then the question is whether the rally will hold, or how much of the rally holds on a subsequent pullback. But rather than paying for something that is really overextended, that the momentum environment where a small number of shares were generating most of the returns for the wider market is over for the moment. And it means that we could be in for a ranging phase for a while longer, and that this first step above the base, considering that the base was 13 years long, that the first step above the base could be potentially lengthy. We could be ranging for a year, or potentially even longer. But that there are significant bullish factors that contribute to the argument that we are in a secular bull market, and it means that major pullbacks in the kinds of assets that you consider attractive can be considered buying opportunities. and that this is no time to get panicky, because this is still a secular bull market environment. And there is very little prospect that we're going to have a recession, particularly on Wall Street. That over the last 30 years, an inversion of the yield curve has represented at least an 18-month lead indicator. And frankly, we're nowhere near inverted right now. So there's probably not a great deal to worry about, but monetary accommodation has contributed to some very leveraged positions having been built up. And the absence of additional monetary accommodation, particularly from the Fed, is going to put some of those under pressure. The fact that computers can engage in groupthink just like people means that we're going to be in for a volatile environment. And it means that nimble traders will have the opportunity to get very nice deals during periods of extreme volatility, but that for investors, that it wouldn't be the best time to be panicking. Well, I think with that, I will leave you for today. I'll wish all the best to all of you.